Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, Global Alternative Strategist, and my guest today is Stephen Dulake, co-head of Global Fundamental Research at JP Morgan. Stephen has been with JP Morgan for over 20 years. He oversees global equity, credit, securitized product, and public finance research. Stephen is one of the leading fixed income strategy research analysts covering the US and developed Europe, and has been ranked in various global and regional fixed income surveys on numerous occasions. On today's episode, we will be discussing private credit, which has seen immense investor interest due to the high yields on offer compared to traditional fixed income. We'll touch on what's driving this growth in the private credit industry, why yields have tended to be higher than public fixed income, and where we see them heading, as well as risks and opportunities in this asset class. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Stephen, really glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get into the conversation, I'd love to hear some background on your own career and what's led you to your position today as co-head of Global Fundamental Research in JP Morgan.
Sure. Very briefly, I mean, as you mentioned, I've been around quite some time here at JP Morgan. So actually 22 years come early October. Prior to that, I was at Morgan Stanley for about 9 years. Geographically, I spent most of my career in London, but for the past 8 or so years, I've been based here in New York. Historically, I've been a debt/credit person for much of my career. And then actually on July 3rd last year, we created Fundamental Research at JP Morgan. So I think what the sort of method in the madness, so to speak, was to sort of throw together two world-class organizations, namely our sort of global equity research business together with our spread research operation. And I think the sort of intention was that, when relevant, and I think that's a key thing. I think the opportunities are, in my mind, episodic. When relevant, I think it's important that we present both the view from both sides of the house. And I think that can be to our clients' benefit. And I think, you know, we can achieve various other economies of scale by putting these two organizations together. But I won't bore you with the details on a day-to-day basis of what we do.
Well, it's fascinating. You've got a massive global reach covering both debt and equity. So today I'd love to focus on private credit specifically. Yep. And this asset class is by no means new, but to some it might be unfamiliar.
Yes.
Particularly those who invested in public fixed income. So how do you approach a conversation with an investor who's new to private credit in explaining what it is and how it differs from traditional fixed income?
I think increasingly, private credit is seen less of, so obviously we're here to talk about the alternative asset class, but in some respects in debt capital markets, I think is increasingly seen, at least by companies, as an alternative solution to public markets, be it high yield bonds, leverage loans. I think there's a particular appeal for a company to go that route, but essentially, when we talk about private credit, we're talking about the direct lending environment. So essentially bilateral loans typically between one lender rather than a syndicate. Mm-hmm. Typically, there will be a sort of a lot more flexibility in dealing with one and complexity in dealing with one lender as opposed to a large syndicate of lenders. So when we talk about private credit, historically, that's what we spent a lot of our time doing, but the reach has been growing. So there's a lot of talk about private investment grade credit, which is sort of a new area of focus. And that area has also been evolving. So I think private credit, you know, the definition of it really depends on who you talk to. But essentially, what we're talking is about the capital market or capital solutions away from the sort of syndicated markets, if you like.
Yeah. And as I understand it, a lot of it is maybe public fixed income investors may be used to fixed rates, whereas
yes,
a lot of private credit is floating rate.
That's correct.
That's correct. It's typically a floating rate market. It's an alternative to the broadly syndicated loan market, if you think about it in those terms, which is also floating rate. But typically, rather than dealing with a broad syndicate, you're dealing with one or two lenders.
Yeah.
And companies.
Or direct relationships.
And companies, yeah. Companies choose to go, may choose to go that route for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. And we're already kind of getting into this, but the space has grown massively over the last probably decade and a half since the global financial crisis, I think particularly. Can you talk to the growth? And I know direct lending is a big part of it, but there's other areas as well that are seeing a lot of growth.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first and foremost, if we're sort of talking about the acceleration in funds or capital raised, not all committed, but capital raised, you know, I think that one of the reasons why you saw that, or the attractiveness, simply yields weren't available on alternative public market investments, sort of the so-called reach for yield. I also think, you know, if you think back over the past decade, you know, maybe even over the past 5 years, we've sort of had a number of wobbles, either related to the pandemic, which nobody foresaw, then the regional issues with the regional banks here in Europe. And I think that really sort of brought private credit into the consciousness, because I think people saw that it could play very important and stabilizing role in terms of the kind of credit ecosystem. Companies had a place to go other than banks and the broadly syndicated market when it was closed because of excess volatility. So I think there are a number of reasons for the growth, but it's certainly been a very attractive place if you're a holder of long-term sticky capital and you're looking to match long-term liabilities. So some of the biggest participants, at least on the investor side, or in terms of those committing capital, would typically be insurance companies, pension funds, endowments, etc.
And I do want to come back to the yield question, particularly as we've had a Federal Reserve rate cut and a lot of talk about where yields might be headed. But just staying on that growth, and I'm a reader of your research. You've talked a lot about the amount of capital that's coming into the private credit industry. Some of that maybe has led to some spread compression.
Yes.
If I can be a little provocative, is there a bubble forming in private credit? That's a question I get from clients quite a lot. I'd love to hear how you answer the question.
I don't think so. I mean, if you think about what characterizes financial accidents, I would say there are a number of things. I would say, firstly, hoarding and crowding, which pushes pricing to excessive levels. I think, to your point, we've definitely seen some convergence in pricing between public and private markets. I think that reflects an increasing fungibility of capital. So to my earlier point that private credit is increasingly seen as an alternative venue for a debt capital market solution, I think that has, you've seen an increased number of deals which maybe start off private, become public, in some cases public to private. So I think you've had some natural convergence as a result of that fungibility of capital as the asset class has matured somewhat, I think, versus private markets. I mean, I'd be much more worried if you had a sense that back-end leverage was really, really high and pricing, private credit was pricing on top of public markets. That, to me, would be a little bit more worrying, but there is still something of a premium, or even though it has been eroded to some degree. And then more importantly, coming back to this idea of bubbles and financial accidents, or bubbles as precursors to financial accidents, unclear to me. There's a lot of back-end leverage. Pricing has converged, but it doesn't feel excessive right now. And more importantly, doesn't feel like there's an obvious asset liability mismatch. So if you think about, you know, who's committing capital, it's those holders of long-term sticky capital. I think it's when you have an asset liability mismatch that you run the risk of some kind of asset liability mismatch against the backdrop of leverage and excess pricing. Those to me seem the three things which would drive, you know, if you could make the case for a bubble and would cause you to cause you concern that there's some accident in the future or some accident brewing.
Right. So you're not concerned about that sort of
situation. There are things we're focused on, sure. Yeah. I don't want to pretend that we don't think there are things to focus on, let's say, and we can get into that in a little bit.
But that's what I found in conversations with folks that are focused on even the fixed income side or any kind of debt markets. It's all about the downside risk.
Yes.
Right. And so that seems to be a kind of a trend. And
well, naturally, credit's an asset class where you get repaid par, or maybe a bit more than par sometimes, but repaid par. And your downside is the sort of negative tail is much bigger than the positive tail.
Yeah, there you go.
And that's a glass with an asymmetric payoff. But
so if we look at the upside in terms of the yields and in comparison to what's available in the public markets, that seems to be what's driving a lot of the interest.
Yeah.
What kind of premiums do you see relative to public, and do you expect that to persist?
It's a really good question. I would say broadly speaking, right now the premium we look at, there are a variety of data sources you can look at. We also have some access to some of our own internal data along the right permissioning. So when we look at private market originations and we compare that to, let's say, the B3 loan cohort in the broadly syndicated market, you know, the spread differential is sort of 150 basis points. And I think, high absolute yields, attractive risk-adjusted returns, which I think is a point that you brought up to me previously. I think, you know, high yields, attractive risk-adjusted returns, those things have garnered a lot of investor interest. Mm.
Yeah, they're the strong selling points of private Correct. Credit today relative to
yes.
public. And when we think about yields, we've just had a Federal Reserve rate cut, 25 basis points. We might have another full percentage point cut over the next year or so. How do you see private credit yields impacted?
It's definitely going to pressure forward returns. I mean, if you're talking about investments which are indexed to short-term rates, even in a world where that spread differential remains at 100 to 150, absolute returns will come down as short-term rates come down. It has been quite notable if you look at capital that's being committed to the asset class. I'd say a couple of things. One, it's begun to slow a little bit, so you still are seeing capital being committed. So the delta quarter on quarter is positive. Mm-hmm. But you've also seen a slowdown in originations, and I think that also owes to the fact that the economics in the broadly syndicated market are somewhat more compelling at the moment. So one of the trends we've been seeing is that deals originated in the private space, typically LBOs, M&A related transactions, typically have been getting refinanced into the public space recently with a 12 or 18 month lag.
Mm.
So the sort of private credit has been this LBO M&A financing venue, and the broadly syndicated loan market has by and large been a refinancing venue.
Right. So you're seeing deals trade back and forth
yes.
between public and private.
Yes.
And even on the equity side, we see that we've seen a number of companies this year taken private from
yep.
from stock exchanges. So
right.
interesting to see that on the debt markets as well. So we'd be remiss not to discuss risks. What are some of the areas that you look at in terms of assessing risk within private credit? And are there any areas you're particularly focused on?
Yeah, it's, I would say a number of things. One, the growing level of retail participation relative to institutional participation. I mean, I think that sort of retail investors' conception of liquidity isn't maybe quite what the asset class offers. And I sort of do worry a little bit about growing retail participation in a deeply illiquid asset class. So all of this talk about, I don't want to say that I don't believe in democracy as a statement, but you know, the democratization of private markets through retail participation, you know, in thinking about potential for asset liability mismatches, it's something to keep an eye on.
So investors coming in expecting that they can sort of treat private credit the same as maybe the more liquid public
correct
asset classes, rather correct than committing to it as a long-term investor.
Correct. We're some way away from that, I think, but it's something that it's worth keeping an eye on. I would say vintage, you know, companies, you know, or if you think about companies who borrowed or deals that were underwritten in sort of second half of 20 and 21, immediately post-pandemic, those were deals which were underwritten at very low interest rates, or in short-term rates were very, very low. And as much as, you know, interest rates have been coming down and we expect more easing sequentially by the Fed, I think that vintage is something to keep an eye on in terms of, you know, whether those cap structures are actually built for the sorts of interest rates where we're likely to coalesce around over the where we're likely to coalesce around over the next 12 months or so, once the Fed is done, which is of course what the firm's forecast is. I think there's definitely a focus on a couple of other things. So business development companies are the public market window into the world of private credit.
Right.
And so people spend quite a bit of time poring over BDC portfolios as an indicator of what's happening in the asset class more broadly. And I guess there have been a couple of things which investors have been focused on and asking questions about. Firstly, the proportion of the portfolio which is picking essentially non-cash accrual.
Right.
That has been rising, and is this a forerunner of defaults, in the same way that when you look at the distressed ratio in public markets, i.e. the sort of quantum of bonds and loans trading below 80 cents is a pretty good predictor of defaults 12 months forward. I think the answer to that is we don't know, because we just don't have the wealth of information through the cycle information to refute it. Not all picks are created the same. Pick is there to sometimes offer a company flexibility, so it isn't necessarily always a precursor to default, but TBD. And then the other thing, in a world where we're all focused on AI and disruption, you know, it's noteworthy that technology, BDC portfolios are quite technology heavy and software heavy in particular. So there's something of a focus on the sort of allocation, sectoral allocation within portfolios. So we're looking at all of those things. And then lastly, insurance company exposure to private credit and structured assets, again, is something which investors are quite focused on, and we spent quite a bit of time writing about. The one thing I would say again is said insurance company exposures have been rising, but again, insurance companies are typically holders of long-term sticky capital. So exposures may be building, but it's unclear that an asset liability mismatch is.
Yeah, you still got, they're long-term committed to the correct asset class and investing in for the long-term. We get a lot of questions around that peak, the payment in kind. So yep, kind of instead of paying out interest payments, they're adding the interest to the principal and sort of a yep promise to pay at the end. And I've kind of started terming them as payment in kind as a kind of a payment.
Yes.
So, there's some question marks around portfolios Correct. That have a large amount of peak, but as you said, sometimes it makes sense. It's software companies that are developing a piece of software.
I guess we don't want to get too nerdy and too nitty gritty, but, there's a concept of, from one of my colleagues who are here, he would talk about the difference between offensive and defensive pick.
Okay.
So, anyway,
there's a good pick and there's bad.
Yeah,
pick.
We can get into that another time.
Yeah, that's something we get a lot of questions around. I think in terms of how do you assess the risk in portfolios. So, it's something I think that can be measured to an extent, but when we look at default rates, for example, we're not seeing them as measurably higher.
I would say exactly. I think it's a very good point. I mean, again, we do have some sources where we can get some data on private credit default rates. It's unclear that default rates right now are very different from what you see or observe in public markets. And actually, one of the sort of large alternative lenders were kind enough to loan us some data, and we were able to look back through the cycle based on their own portfolio information. And I would say, this idea that in a downturn, private credit necessarily underperforms and generates outsized losses. That's not borne out by the data, at least the data that we've been able to look at. I guess the counter is, well, so much capital has been committed so quickly that surely some corners must have been cut. Again, I think maybe we won't really know the answer to that question until we get into a recession, and that doesn't feel a very likely possibility anytime soon.
Yeah, certainly not our base case right now.
No.
And I think a valid question that we've had a lot of capital come in post-financial crisis. You don't really the financial crisis really wasn't a big data point for private credit, but maybe COVID was a data point where the sector performed quite well through the COVID period.
Yeah, and I also think the regional bank stress was a very interesting period, because if you recall at the time, there were a lot of economists that got very negative about the prospects for the US economy, and there was all the talk about lack of credit availability. And I think one of the points that we tried to make at the time was that there are venues that companies go to other than banks and public markets. And I think actually private credit stood out actually as a stabilizing rather than a destabilizing force. There's a reason why a company might go private, because in dealing with one or two lenders, you have that surety of execution. You potentially have more flexibility. So from an investor perspective, while you might look at that higher spread or yield as some kind of illiquidity premium, a company looks at it, I think, as an option premium on that certainty of execution in terms of the flexibility options which may be available to them.
That's a helpful way to look at it. Yep. And even if you look on the equity side, private equity sort of fulfills the same function.
Yes.
So it's in a time where it's difficult to launch an IPO, there's often ample capital available for private equity financing. And so looking ahead, what do you see as the next leg of evolution within private credit?
I think it's a little more of the same, if I'm honest. I mean, I think that in terms of fungibility and convergence, if I think about the direct lending segment, I think it's more of the same. So that fungibility of capital, that convergence of pricing. But I do think, we are seeing a market in private investment grade credit develop. I think initially the thought was this sort of private credit solutions would center around companies that required some form of bespoke solution to a balance sheet problem and required some level of, let's call it, pref capital or subordinated capital. And I think in the early days that was true, but there's been one notable transaction which was all about financing a utilities sort of fairly lumpy capex program. And although the sort of unsecured, very investment grade debt historically has traded at very tight spreads, the reason that the company was willing to pay what seemed to be quite a premium relative to sort of the historical spreads at which they could borrow at was because there was the ability for a delayed draw.
Mm.
So the company was paying for that optionality up front, and that was reflected in the spread. So actually, I think the reach of private investment grade credit is broadening, and I think that's going to be probably one of the growth areas over the sort of next 12, 24, 36 months.
Very good. Well, Stephen, thanks very much for coming on the podcast. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
That was Stephen Dulake, co-head of Global Fundamental Research at JP Morgan. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our recently released third quarter 2025 guide to alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to the Alternative Realities podcast on your favorite podcasting platform.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.